We've all heard about anemia and iron deficiencies hurting our athletic performance and our overall energy level. But the latest thing is iron overload and dumping iron. So is iron good or bad? The answer is yes. Iron is both a toxin and a nutrient. What I've learned for myself is the older athlete needs just enough iron, but no more. So the right question is, how to tell where you are on iron storage in your body? And how can you help your body not hold too much while avoiding having too little? Too little iron means chronic fatigue, brain fog, and breathlessness. Diets low in animal proteins, frequent hard workouts, low stomach acid, gut issues causing poor nutrient absorption, and of course bleeding can lead to lower iron. Too much iron, unless dramatic, is harder to feel and more likely for the older athlete. Without blood loss, iron tends to accumulate in organs during aging and leads to dementia, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and much more, and is worsened by drinking alcohol. Donating whole blood can lower iron, but moves the needle very slowly, as only 100 to 250 milligrams of your total 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams of iron is lost at each donation. Obviously, the key is to plan ahead. So, how to know if you are high or low, or on the verge of being high or low? How to know if donating whole blood every 8 weeks is a good idea, or a terrible one? How can you make donating blood less unpleasant? And what else can you do to stay in your iron sweet spot and to avoid both of these terrible outcomes for athletic performance, quality of life, and overall health? To answer these questions and more, today on episode 139, I am joined by Dr. Grant Frazier, who is board certified in the United States in anti-aging and regenerative medicine and in family medicine, and holds other emergency medicine certifications in Australia. So listen in while Dr. Frazier helps me to sort out what is going on and how to plan ahead to get into the iron sweet spot. And while we don't boil the vast ocean on the topic of iron in this 60-minute chat, we do cover a lot of useful ground. This conversation has changed my personal health program, and I hope you learn a ton as well. All right, let's talk to Dr. Frazier. Dr. Grant Frazier, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Good morning, Joe. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hey, thanks for taking some time for us here. But let's jump into this thing. The audience should know a bit about your background here so that they'll know that they really should be listening to what you have to say. You are board certified in anti-aging and regenerative medicine. Is that right?
That is correct. That's one of my four board certifications. So I am also a board certified family medicine physician in the United States. And in Australia, I am a board certified GP and also board certified by the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine with the generalist emergency medicine specialty on top of that, and primarily work in anti-aging and in urban emergency medicine in Nashville, Tennessee.
Wow. I didn't know some of that. So great. I'm glad to have you on the show. My guess is that I would like to talk to you about a lot of things. Today, the topic is iron. And if we have some time at the end, we'll throw on some discussion of vitamin D, which is another hot topic. But iron has long been a mystery to me. You know, as a Conan the Barbarian fan, you know, iron was like, you know, good, right? So more iron would be better. That was sort of all that I knew. Less iron was bad somehow. But, you know, I just didn't think that it really applied to me. That was kind of a thing for women, or maybe children needed to get it. Plus, it was really confusing, right? I mean, what the heck is ferritin? And no, transferritin? No, what is, okay, so I see the iron in my blood test, but what does that mean? And how does it relate to these other things? And does it matter if I don't have any symptoms? And since I don't have any symptoms, I'm just not going to get into this thing. But then I heard that there's actually iron overload, which is, I mean, I guess it's a real thing for people with a genetic issue. But for regular people, as they get older, iron tends to accumulate in organs. So now I'm like, oh gosh, maybe this is something for me. In fact, I've been so frankly worried about it that I've started donating blood regularly. But it occurred to me after some discussions with you online that I had no idea what I was doing. I was just donating blood. And since I didn't feel bad, you know, I thought it was okay, but maybe it's not okay. So anyway, thank you for coming here to help me, help our audience to understand what is this iron thing? Why is it important? And how do we get into that sweet spot of not too much and not too little?
Absolutely. I think that it is complicated when you take a look at iron studies and interpreting them. I think there's a real risk in ordering your own and interpreting your own studies because it's actually fairly complicated. There's a number of things that need to get looked at, and it's a combination of all those things and the clinical context of what's going on that can make this very confusing. There are risks with being iron deficient and with iron overload. So there's a sweet spot, as with most things in life, that you have, a low level has consequences and a high level has consequences. Iron deficiency, despite iron being a very common element, is most common mineral deficiency. And it is something where we'll cover that a little bit. I think in the older athlete, we're probably a little more interested in iron overload, but also it can be the canary in the coal mine. If you notice with serial iron studies, if you're starting to get a little subtle changes that you're going down in your iron, that can be an indication that you're bleeding internally. And that can be something where if you pay attention to that, you would end up getting something worked up, such as, do you have a gastrointestinal malignancy and you're bleeding internally? Get that worked up before you end up having a long period of time of malignancy that is undiagnosed. So there's definitely some advantages to tracking some of this.
Great.
In regard to the iron studies, the things that we really look at are going to be the size of the red blood cell, is something called MCV, which is the mean corpuscular volume, and the corpuscle is the red blood cell. And iron deficient red blood cells are small, and ones that are full of iron and you have plenty of hemoglobin, which hemoglobin requires iron, end up being a little larger. And then there's also looking at your serum iron, which is the amount of just kind of free iron that is floating around your blood, which is a tiny percent of your iron in your body. And then we have ferritin, which is a protein which binds iron, and that needs to be looked at. And there's things that make that go up or go down. So if you don't have very many iron stores, that ends up being low. If you end up having too many iron stores, that ends up being abnormally high and is probably one of the better measures. But that's complicated by the fact that inflammation will make it go up. So if you had some type of inflammatory condition, that can go up and you can falsely think that you've got elevated amounts of iron stores. And then there's something called total iron binding capacity, which looks at how much iron your transferrin, which is a protein which transports iron from one place to another, is capable of, or is actually binding at this point. And there's a normal percentage, which indicates that you've got plenty of iron in your body. If that's a low percentage, where a low percentage is bound, means that you don't have enough iron oftentimes. So it is something where we have fair amount of detail in this, and it's complicated in taking a look at all of this as far as, are you iron deficient or do you have too much iron?
Interesting. Okay, so if we have time, I'd like to come back to some of these markers and just try to understand a little more about the whys, I mean, if it's known, and then also I know that when I look at my reports, my blood tests, there's normal ranges. And on so many things on blood tests where there's a normal range, it's not clear to me that do I want to be, in the middle of the normal range? Do I want to be at the bottom of the normal range? Is the normal range just sort of like average person? Well, I can look around and say, I don't want to be like the average person. I want to be, more optimal. And I don't think that those ranges are telling me that. So anyway, if we have some time, I'd like to come back to that. Yeah. But let's talk about iron. So one of the things that I've heard about iron in the body is that there really isn't that much of it. And maybe that's a good thing, but maybe because it's so, it's sort of just exactly right for what it does, we don't need that much to accomplish our goals. But there's something like 3 to 5 grams, you know, like the amount of creatine a person might take a day. That's like all the iron in your whole body. Yeah. And in a day, we might absorb 1 or 2 milligrams. So that would be like versus 3 to 5,000 milligrams. That's the equivalent of grams. So obviously, we're not absorbing, we're not getting all of this iron from absorbing it from our food, are we?
Well, you kind of do have to absorb it. And it really is an interesting thing as far as the statistics, as far as, yeah, you do have, you know, 2 to 3 grams or 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams for females and 3,000 to 4,500 milligrams for males. So it's not very much in your entire body. And of that, in men, kind of 2 grams of that is in hemoglobin, in women, 1.5. And then in ferritin, 1 gram and 0.6 of a gram for women. For ferritin, and then hemosiderin takes about 300 milligrams, your muscles and myoglobin about 200 milligrams. And then there's tissue enzymes and enzymes within your mitochondria, which rely on that for energy production, about 150 milligrams. And then the amount that's just kind of floating around your blood that makes up your serum iron is just a few milligrams, actually. And it is something where you take a look at this huge amount of stores and recognize that in general, that absorption of iron is fairly low. And it's kind of interesting as far as how it is maintained. Your body knows whether you need to absorb iron or not. And there's a protein formed by your liver where if it is not formed, it's called hepcidin. If it's not formed, that's telling your intestines that we need to absorb maximum amount of iron. And there is, it's something where there's a specific transporter called ferroportin that binds up iron and moves it across the intestine into the bloodstream. And if there is hepcidin present, so if your body's saying, I don't need to absorb iron, then it is something where hepcidin is made, and then that binds that receptor and makes it unable to transport iron. So it is something where there's a well-regulated system, but it's pretty tough to absorb huge amounts of iron. And it depends on the form of the iron, and plant foods, probably a lower percentage can be absorbed. Oftentimes kind of, you know, 10-20% of the iron in the food can be absorbed. In heme iron, which is in meat, that is something where a more modest percent, probably 30% or so, can be absorbed. But even then, in meat, most of the iron is actually not heme iron. Most of it is actually in the protein. So it's just kind of standard iron that is absorbed at a little bit lower rate, even when you're maximally trying to absorb it.
Okay, so let's revisit some of that. The hemoglobin, that's the stuff that's in the red blood cells that is using the iron to capture oxygen that I breathed into my lungs, and then I'm using that to move the oxygen around my body, and apparently that's the biggest use of it, because you said that was the largest amount. So that one's really important. And I also have read that the body will steal iron when you're low. It'll steal iron from other places in order to make sure you can get enough oxygen around. So it must be oxygen important to us, huh?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting issue. Is that there's so many people that I see that are iron deficient, and they kind of say, "Oh yeah, I've been that way forever," and they don't really recognize what impact it's having on them, because as soon as you start to get a low hemoglobin or anemia, your body is maximally pulling iron from everywhere else. So the functions that the iron has in your mitochondria to make energy, to allow you to think, to allow you to even exercise, all that's getting stolen. So this is a downside of having iron deficiency, is that people don't recognize that they can be feeling really awful and not even having the motivation or ability to exercise, because the iron that would be in their myoglobin, the iron that would be in their mitochondria to allow them to do things, the iron necessary for mental function is gone, and they're not recognizing that it's not a minor condition to be iron deficient, because at that point, everything's getting pulled to your bone marrow and out of every other segment, and you're actually, the rest of your body's just plainly not working properly. And there's just so many people that just kind of go, oh yeah, I'm iron deficient, and not recognizing that that is something that needs to get treated. And if they are unable to orally supplement successfully, which is a lot of people, then other strategies are needed.
Good. Let's hit on some of those. But first, I wanted to go back to this bit about the use of iron and the fact that it's so important for a lot of things, right? You said, I mean, we just talked about how we're using most of it for carrying oxygen around, and the body upregulates that, prioritizes that ahead of everything else. So that's important. You know, yeah, try holding your breath and see how long you can do it. For making energy, you know, maybe some people don't exercise, but they like to think and not feel, you know, cloudy in their minds. So, you know, that's energy. But because it's so important, and we can't get much of it from the food, we just talked about, the body doesn't want to run out. So it stores more than it needs. It's kind of like your bones keep your calcium, and your body will tell your bones to let some calcium go if you're short of calcium. Or if you're on a fast, your body will tell, you know, your muscles to, you know, let go some of that protein because I need it. I got to do something. I got to build some things, and I can't make protein, so I'm going to have some of your protein. Well, the iron is kind of the same. It seems to me that the body is storing some, and this is where the ferritin comes into play, where we have to have extra just in case we don't get any for a while, or this hepcidin has been elevated and we're not absorbing. Maybe we have an infection or something, and that's why our inflammation is up. Anyway, the body has its means for storage, and that's ferritin, as I understand it. And this is this protein you talked about, and it's like in all the cells of the body, and some of it happens to be in the blood, and that's why you can measure it when you do a blood test. But mostly it's just in the cells of the body, and that's where it is storing the iron that the cell might need. Am I understanding that right?
Yes, that is your main storage, and yes, and there's certain organs that have a great deal of storage ability. I mean, liver is one where a lot of it gets stored, but absolutely, there's significant storage with ferritin being the store, and then naturally your red blood cells are effectively a store that gets recycled as those get broken down. That iron gets reclaimed and bound back to ferritin and gets transported places by transferrin as needed back to the bone marrow to be used again.
All right. So the question then is, why is the body so careful with the iron that it hides away in these things? I mean, for one thing, as I've read, iron, just free iron floating around in your body would be very damaging. It can combine with things that your body makes, like hydrogen peroxide, and it would make reactive oxygen species that would damage cell membranes and create all kinds of havoc. And so that would be bad. So the other thing that was amazing to me, and this relates back, I think, to the inflammation, is that if we have infection, we have bacteria that have gotten into our system, the bacteria needs our iron to grow. It needs iron too. And so it wants to steal our iron in order for it to grow. And so our body has, you know, animals back till the dawn of time have developed defenses against this. And one of it is to hide the iron away, and to hide it away even more when we sense an infection. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair call. I mean, it's something where bacteria do very well in the presence of significant iron. And It is something where we see this also when people take oral iron because they absorb very little of it, and the rest of it goes through their intestinal tract and causes distress because the bacteria love it, and most of it is not getting absorbed. But the same way as if you have a bacterial infection, if you have significant levels of iron, it is probably sitting around freely. It is certainly a risk factor for doing poorly, and it also increases oxidative stress, probably DNA damage, and excess of iron. We see all types of bad things happen as far as you know, chronically in your tissues. So something where there is a sweet spot where too much, too little. But yeah, with inflammation, you end up having your, you know, ferritin go up and possibly part of that is that you're, you know, binding up as much iron as you can to not allow access to, to other processes that could use it for bad uses. But, you know, that may well be one of the reasons why you'll end up seeing that go up in the inflammation or infection.
Awesome. Okay. So hopefully we've set the stage here for people to kind of get the sense of the various things that are going on. And going back to the idea that we can't, you know, our body mostly has the iron that it needs or let's just say the iron that it's going to have. We're not just going to eat a bunch of spinach like Popeye and suddenly have a whole bunch more iron in our body. So these iron issues, as I understand it, they can come from short-term immediate things, right? I mean, if you had an accident and you bled a lot, okay, you lost a whole bunch of iron. But a lot of these things tend to happen slowly over time, where you're, you know, various things can happen. And what I think is what helped me to understand it as I was looking into it and getting ready for our talk was to break down the things that happen that can create issues, I think, both on the high end, the low side, but by separating what happens on the iron inside, and then we can talk about what happens on the iron outside, you know, how the body loses iron. And we can talk about then how over time, what sort of shows up, symptoms or even blood markers for iron as it starts to get low. And this will be stuff that people are more familiar with. Yeah. And then we can get into the high iron thing, which is really kind of what I was after. Yeah. So let's first talk about when we eat iron, what is influencing, you know, maybe negatively us getting enough iron or even too much iron into our body?
Yeah. So there's kind of multiple things. You do need to have adequate stomach acid is an important component. Mostly absorption is done in the small bowel through ferroportin. There is also kind of a, there's a cation, which is the form in iron has, two or three plus positive electrons on it. And it is something where other cations like calcium, magnesium, zinc also use a similar transporter. So if you end up taking a whole bunch of those at the same time, that can limit absorption because that same transporter is used to get stuff across and it'll be competitive with the iron. If you have small bowel disease, we see people that have inflammatory bowel disease or have celiac disease that won't absorb iron. So those some people that have had gastric bypass ends up being a factor. So if you have some mechanical issue, that can be a factor. If you end up consuming alcohol, alcohol ends up suppressing the production of hepcidin. So you'll end up absorbing excessive iron with that. If you exercise 3 to 6 hours after a very heavy exercise, you end up increasing your hepcidin after that, so that you'll end up having decreased iron absorption, which could be therapeutic if you're iron overloaded and an athlete. You might want to, if you're going to have some heme iron, having that 3 to 6 hours after a heavy exercise would be the strategic time to do that so you don't absorb as much iron. So there's a number of factors. There's kind of been the probably a myth around vitamin C. There was one study that looked at taking vitamin C with iron, and it really wasn't done properly, and it really does not look like there's any impact on vitamin C with taking iron as far as getting increased absorption. It certainly doesn't seem to diminish absorption, but it's probably not a factor. The forms of iron when people are taking supplements Only a tiny percentage of them are absorbed. And one of the things is that if you take a big load of iron, it actually ends up causing your hepcidin to go up, oftentimes for some period of time, for a day or so, so that if you take a big dose of iron, subsequent doses are unlikely to be absorbed and they just go through your intestinal tract and cause distress. So there's kind of discussions if you're supplementing to do every other day and just kind of a standard supplement where you're getting about 60 milligrams of iron if you're trying to build up your absorption. But even then, you're probably only going to absorb 3 or 5 milligrams, and a lot of people don't. So there's, you know, a lot of factors with this. You know, making sure you're chewing your food properly, so it's properly broken down as it's going through small bowel, is a big factor. You know, and then there's forms of iron that you end up taking, whether it's plant, which ends up having, you know, slight less absorption, or whether it ends up being heme iron that has a little more absorption. But ultimately, if your hepcidin is elevated, you're not going to absorb. And if your hepcidin is low, then you'll try and absorb it as much as you can.
A few follow-ups here. So the stomach acid, I think that sometimes that can be negatively affected as far as high acid by medicines, right? Proton pump inhibitors.
Yeah, that's a real factor. There's proton pump inhibitors were never approved for long-term use. And it is something where there's lots of downsides to being on proton pump inhibitors. It's not just iron absorption. It's multiple issues adverse to health, including, you know, messing up your nitric oxide system and other areas of food that require normal stomach acid. So it's something where we see a lot of people on those long term for reflux, and most people that have reflux do not have excessive acid. A lot of them end up just having excessive abdominal fat, and actually have that be a big factor with this. But it is a real problem. So many people don't recognize that there are some real health consequences. You know, including this, being on proton pump inhibitors, and, you know, now they're, you know, available widely over the counter. We just see a lot of people just chronically on them, not actually thinking about the potential harms to their health and being on those.
Bummer. The proton pump inhibitor thing keeps coming up in episode after episode. So. Okay. And getting back to the plants that you said compete with the iron for absorption. I hadn't heard that. That's good to know. But I had heard that certain, you know, polyphenols or in plants will bind with the iron and keep it from being absorbed. Is that true?
I think that there is some evidence with that you're going to end up having some binding with some of the polyphenols. But it's probably not hugely significant, given that we're looking at on a good day, you're only going to be absorbing 1 to 3 milligrams if you need to absorb. And most of the time, your dietary intake ends up being such a massive amount more than that, that in general, you're not going to have a huge issue with that. But certainly there, you know, some of the lentils, some of the things that have phytates in them, can end up having a significant binding of, and it can be therapeutic for people with iron overload.
Right.
You know, in general, if you've got a mixed diet, it's probably not a big concern for most people. But it would be something to consider if you had an iron deficiency and you had an unusual diet that was, you know, that was very high in those substances. You would have to consider, you know, is it something in my diet which is blocking some of the absorption?
Right. All right. So, again, these are just things that affected how much iron you got into your body, independent of whether you wanted more or you wanted less iron, because these give you strategies, levers you can pull to try to lower it if you have too much, or increase it if you have too little. But generally speaking, these are going to be slow. Even taking the supplements is going to be slow. It's going to take a long time for this to make a difference. And so the other side of the equation is the iron out. And so, you know, the obvious thing is bleeding. That would be kind of a big use or loss of blood. And you had mentioned things like bowel cancer, I maybe like a bleeding ulcer type of a thing might, you know, be in the same kind of category. People who have had surgeries, they lose some blood, although they also get blood in surgeries. And I've read that people who get lots of transfusions can end up with too much iron. And then, of course, premenopausal women, you know, everybody in my family in particular is more on the low side, you know, because of a regular loss of blood there. What are some of the other things that influence how much iron we are losing?
Yeah. So I think the main thing as far as regular blood loss is going to be menstruating woman. That is something which is, you know, interesting in regard to genetic conditions like hemochromatosis, where you have a gene that basically has you not build hepcidin appropriately so that you're always wanting to absorb. And in women who have hemochromatosis or have those genes, most of the time because of those losses, they don't end up actually manifesting any of the signs of iron overload until they stop menstruating. Mm-hmm. So with men, they're going to manifest it much earlier because they don't have those losses. Other things that we see are going to be, you know, people that aren't, as far as losses go, intestinal bleeding is the primary one where people won't know about it because you know, if you have it from your stomach, then that stomach touches acid, and that ends up making the stool black at that point because it ends up causing hemolysis of the red blood cells. And then people will kind of get a little bit of a sense because they'll have kind of black, sticky, tarry stools. But that's only when they're bleeding a fair amount. If they're only bleeding a little bit, it may be very subtle. But it is something where if you have black stools, you know, and you're not taking Pepto-Bismol or not taking iron, you're probably, you know, you'd want to test to make sure there's not occult blood in that. But if it's bleeding anywhere from this, anywhere below the stomach, you're not going to get any real tips with it because it's usually going to be a slow amount. You're not going to see red. It's just going to blend in unless it's bleeding a fair bit. So you can lose over time small amounts. And the first thing can be that when you get a blood test that they see that your blood count's down, your MCV is down, those types of things. And you know, but it would be much better if you were to look at iron studies because you would pick it up long before on iron studies before you actually got anemic because there's a long process before your body starts actually allowing you to get anemic where it's going to rob that iron and you'll see those iron studies become abnormal. So it can really be something where if you're really surveilling yourself, it's a really good thing to look at because you're going to get warnings long before anemia. Anemia is a late sign. You know, other things that we see, you know, in endurance athletes, we'll see, you know, abnormal intestinal permeability and, you know, leaking of blood through the intestinal tract. We see this as something, you know, in kind of the ultra, you know, marathoners and so forth, we'll end up seeing that happen as part of their activities. So it's usually not kind of your, you know, short and medium duration athletes, but your folks that are really going for it a lot of times to get altered gut permeability and will have GI losses without there being, you know, really clear disease. You'll see things that probably, you know, can cause anemia. There's kind of this foot strike hemolysis, long distance running, but you still don't usually lose iron, but you can end up damaging your hemoglobin and breaking it down a bit. And then you get iron losses and sweat is your other thing. You know, kind of your average person, you know, doing kind of standard exercise may lose about a milligram in sweat. But people that are doing much more activity, you know, can certainly lose kind of 3 to 5 milligrams per day in intense sweating. And I presume also probably people that are doing, you know, saunas and so forth. So, I mean, those are potential areas of losses that you can have.
Well, it really just goes to show that, especially if you're getting your own blood tests and you see that you're, you know, maybe you suspect that maybe you're a little low And then you think, well, I'll just take some iron supplements. I can buy them along with my vitamin C and my creatine and my whatever. That might be a terrible mistake because you might be covering up a clue that something serious is happening. So figuring out why your iron is low sounds really important.
I think tracking these things over time is really valuable because if you take a look and say your MCV tends to be very, very stable over time. So, you know, if normal MCV is kind of 80 to 100 is pretty normal range. I mean, every lab has a little bit of difference with that. You know, if you have an inherited condition like a thalassemia, you can have small red blood cells, but we'll exclude those people from discussion because they're going to be anemic. They're going to have other things that are beyond the scope of this discussion. But for people that don't have those things, you know, if you see your red blood cells getting a bit smaller over time, that would suggest, you know, hey, maybe you are losing iron and you're putting less hemoglobin into each cell. That'd be a subtle sign early if you're starting to see that drop. If you're starting to see it go up, you could have a vitamin B12 or folate deficiency. You could be drinking too much alcohol, which you would know about, which will oftentimes raise that. You could also have, the beginnings of something called myelodysplasia. Other hints you'll get is that your red cell distribution width can go up if you've got abnormal cells that are being formed, if you're kicking out more red blood cells than you're supposed to. And that's not to get too technical. It's something where if you have two different populations of cells, so you have like your normal red blood cells, and then you have other ones that are being formed that are different in size, that red cell distribution width will become abnormally large. So, and that's something where that would be a hint that there's something where you probably need to see a physician if you're seeing that RDW go up, because there's a wide range of things. Other things that you would see is that, you know, if your ferritin is starting to come down and you've, you know, had a normal level and that's starting to drop down, you're saying, you know, your body's stores of iron are coming down, you know, that's going to happen long before you get changes in your MCV or in your RDW. So those are tips. You know, if you're seeing that your TIBC is, going up, if your transferrin is going up, if your transferrin saturation is going down, all things that would give you a much earlier hint that you're potentially losing blood from somewhere and your iron stores are getting low. So those would be, you know, this is something where if you're paying attention and you see those types of things happening, that can be an early warning that, hey, I've got a problem and I need to get this sorted out before it goes any further.
Got it. Okay, so one last thing, and then we'll jump into the high iron thing. Hearing what you've said and some other things, I'm going to throw this out and correct anything that I say that's not right. The first thing is that since your body is protecting your hemoglobin, that really is sort of near the end. The ferritin is more the early sign of something happening, and you might not feel anything in your body as a result. And then as it moves up, you start to have more like energy issues where your body's been stealing the iron from energy production in order to have enough for the red blood cells. So you maybe brain fog or, you know, whatever you had described earlier in the conversation. And then the last stage is where you actually like have anemia, where you don't have enough red blood cells, you can't catch your breath, things like that. Is that basically how it moves?
Yeah, I think it's something where you know, the value of lab monitoring is really important. If you take a look and say, you know, your ferritin, which looks at stores, a lot of people are going to be, 50, 100, 150 on their ferritin. By the time we all even call stage one iron depletion, your ferritin has to be less than 20. So, I mean, that is a dramatic drop from where you were, 50 or 100 or 150. It has to be less than 20 before we're even saying, hey, you've got iron depletion at stage one. And then probably, you know, your symptoms when you're starting now to have to rob from other cellular functions, from myoglobin, from mitochondria, and so forth, you even have to drop a few more points below that, And then it's only when that ends up getting depleted even lower that you end up then getting anemia. So it's something where there's quite a process. I mean, because your red blood cells are the final thing. So when you actually get anemic from this, this is a process that's very far along by that time, and you will have had all the other symptoms. But you know, if somebody just, you know, if your doctor goes, "You're not anemic," that's actually not the question, because you will have completely robbed all of the iron from every other cellular function, and from your muscles, from your brain, from, you know, everything else, long before you actually show up with anemia. It's a very late finding.
Okay, good. All right. So low iron is a thing. It's very important, but just as important is high iron. So let's talk about that. This is the new thing for me. And I understand that it's a serious problem for people with this genetic thing where they don't make enough hepcidin, and so they absorb too much and maybe have other problems with that. But for people who don't have that problem, they still can have high iron. And I want to distinguish between like the really, really high iron that's obvious. You know, you do a blood test and you see it and it's like, holy cow, we've got to do something here, versus a person like me. I'm sort of in the green on everything. But yet I'm an older athlete, I'm an older person, and iron tends to accumulate in my organs as I get older. And why is that? You know, is it just a kind of just the same old thing? Homeostasis systems just don't work as well. You know, maybe it was because, I mean, I never drank a lot of alcohol. Well, I guess if you don't count college, but, you know, maybe it's from a history of drinking regularly, or maybe it's because I ate a lot of iron foods, you know, in my life. I, you know, I've never been a vegan, or she never liked my vegetables until recently. And also taking supplements over the years, you know, and I've heard that things like taking too much zinc or getting copper out of balance with things. Anyway, why does this happen to regular people who don't have a genetic predisposition to it?
Yeah, I think that it is something where you don't have a good mechanism of getting rid of iron. And it is something where you may well have times where you don't have adequate hepcidin and you end up absorbing a little bit more. And it is something which is common. But I wouldn't downplay the possibility of a genetic condition when you take a look at hemochromatosis. You know, if you're Northern European, it, as far as having at least one copy of the gene, it's between 5 and 10% of people. Mm. So, and it's something where, you know, looking more Southern European, you know, it's somewhere in the range of 2 to 5%, at least having one copy of the gene, which can have an impact. And you can get, you know, genetic testing for hemochromatosis for the HFE gene, you know, but it is, you know, Northern European people, it's, you know, about, you know, 0.5% of people end up actually having, you know, full blown hemochromatosis, of which a lot of not diagnosed. So that may be a factor. But, you know, if you just have one copy of the gene, you can definitely tend to have your hepcidin run inappropriately low. So that can be a factor. So, you know, I think it is something where if you were to tend to have a ferritin that was going up and you didn't have a inflammatory condition that could explain it, that may be a factor. That would certainly be something to consider. But, you know, why do we care about it being, you know, kind of in this where it's not incredibly toxic, you know, where you say this is, you know, some emergency. I mean, if you have a ferritin greater than 1,000 and you don't have an inflammatory condition, you're at significant risk in the short term of, you know, having significant, you know, cirrhosis and other complications from this. And, you know, it really is an urgency. And then there's a lot of people that kind of, you know, sit in that, you know, 300 to 500 range where you kind of go, you know, this is abnormal. And what are the consequences to that? And I think that it probably is on a spectrum, you know, as far as, you know, looking, going, okay, well, for iron overload, what do you get with that? You know, you end up getting, you know, issues with neurotoxicity. You get, you know, accumulation of iron in the brain, which incidentally, if you, you know, if you end up removing iron from the body, that iron probably does not come out. And we see the same thing with iron deposition in joints, with arthritis, with this. When you end up getting rid of iron, once you've already got iron in the joints, it probably does not come out. It's probably irreversible. So those are, you know, concerns. And there's certainly a link between getting, you know, dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, Parkinson's disease, neurodegenerative disease, and having iron overload. You get liver damage. You end up getting cirrhosis. You end up getting excess levels of hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer. You know, vascular disease, you end up getting excessive reactive oxygen species and damage to your endothelium, and atherosclerosis, increased rate of heart disease. You can get a restrictive cardiomyopathy where you end up infiltrating the heart muscle, the myocardium, and that usually reverses with, and as does the liver stuff, except for if you get cancer, with removal of iron. You can get damage to your kidney and get chronic kidney disease. With this, you can, you know, you get an increased rate of infections, as you would expect. If you've got too much iron, you end up having a nice setup for bacteria to come in. Let's see, we discussed, you know, kind of the joints with, an arthritis that oftentimes is pretty difficult to treat and oftentimes irreversible. You can mess up your pancreas and you get increased insulin resistance, and you can infiltrate your pancreas and have it stop secreting insulin, and then aging, you know, which is a big concern. You get oxidative stress, you get DNA damage due to reactive oxygen species. You end up iron overload will impair your mitochondrial function, you know, where if you have too much, you have a problem. If you have too little, you have an issue. Shortens your telomeres. So you're probably, you know, aging too rapidly, impacts stem cells. You know, can, you know, mess up your thyroid. You can, pituitary can end up getting issues with, dysfunction, adrenals. Also, reproductive hormones can go bad. You can bronze your skin, where if you have, you know, really high levels of iron, you actually will get a change in your skin pigmentation. So if you see somebody of Northern European descent who suddenly ends up looking artificially tan and bronze, they've probably got a problem with their problem with this. And then I think the last thing is, you know, the discussion on kind of, you know, mTOR signaling is that it ends up probably driving mTOR and driving aging. So I think that those are probably, you know, pretty good summary of why you don't want too much iron.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of things that I think we should add is that, I mean, we talked earlier about alcohol. So, I mean, if you're worried about high iron, you should really be careful about alcohol intake because it increases absorption, right?
It does. You end up with alcohol use, you end up suppressing your liver from making hepcidin, which then basically tells your body that you need to absorb whatever iron you can.
Okay. And then I've also heard that estrogen supplementation or high estrogen increases absorption. And so I guess postmenopausal women will be using bioidentical estrogen, and I don't know whether the levels of estrogen in an obese man might get high enough to affect this. But is estrogen a thing to keep an eye on?
I think it is something where it can be a factor. I think it's the issue with a lot of women that were supplementing estrogen is it also that they are postmenopausal, so they're not bleeding any longer. You know, the spikes in estrogen are oftentimes timed to menstrual cycle, such that after a cycle that you end up having some absorption. So it's kind of right after you bleed that the estrogen starts going back up when somebody is having menstrual cycles and maximizes absorption, anticipating that they're going to bleed again. But it is something where we kind of have a steady state when we're doing estrogen supplementation postmenopausal. And that certainly can be a factor as far as having a little more absorption, and probably not a huge factor and something where I really wouldn't necessarily change having somebody on hormone replacement as a result of it, but it certainly can be a factor along with not having any further bleeding.
Well, right. And so, yeah, the idea would be with, I guess, really any of these things, other than maybe make sure that you're not supplementing with iron in your multivitamin or something crazy like that. But, you know, I mean, if you want to drink alcohol because that's an important part of your life, then you should pull some other levers to lower iron absorption that we've talked about earlier. Okay, so the last thing that I wanted to get at, and I don't think we've mentioned it here, and it really is the thing that stimulated me to want to talk to you about this, and that's donating blood.
Yes.
Ever since I have been sort of worried about this iron overload thing, even though I'm in the green on all of my blood markers, I've been donating whole blood every 3 months. And so is that a smart thing to do? I mean, obviously, if I was in the red and I had high iron, then that'd be a great thing to do because, you know, the bleeding is the fastest way. Let's get into this. You know, people like me, I'm older and I'm getting older, right? I mean, that's my goal anyway. I want to keep getting older. I'm trying to keep my body functioning properly, but, you know, I'm sort of working against the odds, do what I can, but still things just don't seem to work as well. And that would include my homeostasis for my iron. And so if I'm eating a lot of iron because I like that kind of food, you know, I'm not bleeding at all, you know, except for the occasional shaving accident. You know, should I be donating blood? Should I be trying to get my blood markers? How do I get my blood markers for iron more optimal to ward off any effect on neurological diseases or heart disease or kidney disease or liver disease that might be being driven by iron, that by getting lower, not too low, because we've already talked about how bad that would be, but getting lower by donating blood, does that make any sense, or am I just taking a big chance on getting too low?
I think it's a sensible thing to do. There's certainly a fair bit of discussion around this as far as donating and having a lower level of iron stores. I think it's certainly safe to do, you know, down to, you know, ferritin, you know, somewhere, you know, sub 100 is probably very safe and sensible. One of the challenges is that it oftentimes takes a fair bit of donation in order to actually make a difference in these markers, because you do have a fair bit of stores. When you take a look at a unit of blood, they're going to take off about 200 to 250 milliliters, which is going to be somewhere in the range of, you know, 100 to 250 milligrams of iron that they're going to end up taking. So, you know,
of your 3,000, so it's not much.
Or 5,000 for, you know, 4 or 5. Yeah. So it is something where one of the strategies you can do is to do to talk with where you're donating and see if they will do a red blood cell donation, where they actually end up taking the equivalent of 2 units at a time. So what they end up doing with that is, so you'll end up losing 2 units of red blood cells, which is where your iron's going to be. But they end up recycling your plasma, so you don't end up having actually the volume loss. And you can do that donation as often as, I think, every 112 days. So then you would end up not needing as many sticks, not needing as many visits for it. So you can do that kind of 3 times a year. That'll give you double the amount at a visit, but you won't end up having kind of, you know, the hypotension or the dizziness when you stand and so forth, because they actually don't remove very much volume. They're just taking the red blood cells, but you can do a double donation. So that's something to discuss, and that is fairly widely available, rather than just doing whole blood donation, which you can do as often as kind of every 8 weeks. So, because I personally do not like getting stuck or having, you know, blood donation, I'm not a huge fan of that whole process. So if I were to do it, I'd rather go ahead and get as much out at once, if that's what the goal is.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I hadn't heard of that before, and it totally makes sense. If I was more certain than I am that I had high iron, then I would be interested in that as a way of, you know, taking a faster path to lowering my iron. But one of the things that I have thought that I was benefiting by, and this would require losing the plasma, is sort of a losing the old person blood factors, right? You know, this plasmapheresis thing where you get young blood. And I don't, you know, I haven't spoken to my children about being my blood boy. I'm pretty sure my wife wouldn't tolerate that. So, you know, but if I can get rid of some of these old blood factors by, you know, just dumping some of my plasma, I've even heard people talk about donating plasma, right? And so they don't dump their iron. They just get rid of the plasma and they can do it more often and then they can get more of this effect. But what do you think about that? I mean, donating blood, I mean, bloodletting is an old, old medical practice. And donating blood has long been thought of as a, you know, life extension practice. And was that people trying to brainwash us into donating blood? I don't really know. But, you know, with this whole plasmapheresis thing, you know, being a bigger and bigger deal, what do you think about donating blood for that purpose?
I doubt that there is a whole lot of benefit. There's a lot of theories around things, but as far as looking at, you know, high level evidence that makes a difference, I doubt that you can really show that. Along with it, it is something where certainly benefiting other people is something where you're absolutely doing that and probably benefiting yourself in regard to having a lower iron store. You know, if you indeed have a ferritin that is well above 100, it's probably a reasonable thing where you could, you know, go with having less oxidative stress with getting your iron down. So I think on that side, you're making your plasma on a very regular basis and all of this is getting recycled. And yes, you will end up removing some products by having plasmapheresis, which would be an effective way to get rid of a number of proteins out of your system and and have you not recycle those and use those again. But I do think that there's kind of a lot of theory in this space without a lot of evidence of outcome. And there's, you know, naturally, you know, voice boxes who speak very convincingly. But when you take a look at what the data is, it's just kind of not very convincing from my standpoint that you're going to get health benefits out of it. You know, and kind of I think that the other side of it is kind of, you know, the young blood transfusions and those types of things. Probably there is some short-term benefit of that, but I'm not sure we have long-term benefit of that. And when you're doing that, you're then getting additional iron, which is going to then require removal.
Yeah. Wow, that's a double bummer. Okay, so anyway, do good for your community and get rid of your iron. And if you can stand the, you know, the whole setup thing, having them stick that needle in your arm and it sits there for a while, which I'm now well accustomed to, then it's a fine way to do it.
Incidentally on that, one of the things for everybody to be aware of is that if you're not a big fan of that, it is over the counter to get a compound called EMLA, E-M-L-A, which is a uteric mixture of lidocaine. You can put that under either some plastic wrap is probably the best thing so it doesn't get absorbed. But you can put that to both of your antecubital areas where they're going to go, and it will numb up the skin beautifully so that you do not have discomfort with this. So if that's a big factor for people, that is now an over-the-counter anesthetic that gets absorbed through the skin. Put that on 45 minutes before, and you will not have any significant discomfort usually with that part. So if the pain is part of it and that's stopping you from doing it, there's a very good solution, which you can go and get at any of the pharmacies now since it's over the counter.
Fantastic. Never heard of that before. I think I'm going to tell my children about that because they really hate getting shots and giving blood. Yeah. And so for me, I do this. I force myself to be a brave person. This is what I'm going to tell you. And I feel good about myself by forcing myself to be a brave person. And the last time I gave blood, it freaking hurt. But I was like, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to complain. I'm just going to take this pain. But my children, oh no. Okay, Dr. Fraser, this has been really amazing. Thank you for that. I see that we are out of time. In fact, we're over time. And so we don't have time for the vitamin D. What we'll do is we'll come back and we'll do another episode on that, because that's an important question for a lot of people. very important for our health and so hard to solve, it seems like. But for this iron episode, thank you. And can you tell our audience how they can find you, more information that you know you have put out into the world on this topic and maybe other topics, and then we'll schedule another session.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just have my website, which is simple, which is Grant, G-R-A-N-T, Fraser, F-R-A-S-E-R-M-D.com. And I do have some blogs on that site. And I do see patients by telemedicine in Alabama, Arizona, California, Washington State, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Florida, mostly for kind of detailed high-level primary care and longevity medicine, including these type of topics. But please visit the website and take a look at some of the blogs. I have a focus and interest in neurocognitive decline, people at risk of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and everybody who's at risk of death, which is everybody.
I hate that, but yes, indeed. Well, thanks very much for that. Dr. Fraser, again, thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you.
All righty, bye-bye. Thanks for listening in to my chat with Dr. Fraser about iron. You can find more information about Dr. Fraser and his website in the show notes. And be sure to contact Dr. Fraser for more information on iron-related topics that we couldn't fit into this short episode, such as the effect of altitude, sleep apnea, nutritional imbalances, chelation therapy, and other questions important to this topic. Oh, and stay tuned for my next episode with Dr. Fraser on vitamin D. Have a great day.